So, we've been talking about the sin of lying for a long time. I don't know if I've gotten through to you guys enough to make you repent, but maybe that's a measure of whether we're doing a good job here or not. You know, last time we dealt with this verse, 1 Corinthians 13:12, "For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as also I am known." So now, in this life, we see through a glass darkly. When we come to be with the Lord in heaven, we will see things clearly. And this is part of this sin of lying, okay? Part of whether we are telling the truth, but also part of what our perception is of the world. And of course, our perception is determined by the Holy Spirit, who has authority over us. But also, you know, we contribute to that. How much are we darkening our own sphere? How much are we putting blocks to our relationship with God? And how much are we obscuring really the truth of what is out there? There are two ways of being. I want to sort of get into a little bit of Augustine here. Two ways of being that we can be with regard to knowledge, with regard to what the way that we see things. We could be shut up in our own bubble. Remember, we're talking about seeing through a glass darkly now. You can look at that. Remember, we talked about these translucent windows and what a good example of that is, of seeing through this glass darkly. There's light out there, but because of our sin, the truth of things is obscured, and so we don't see it very well. There's light, but we don't see things very well. Are we shut up in our little bubble, okay? And this is something that we do to ourselves, okay? We obscure things to ourselves. Part of the way that we do that is when we want to know something, okay, we look at ourselves and we say that we're the ones with the knowledge, okay? We're the ones, we've got this knowledge, we've got these facts, we hold them to ourselves. And we also make our own interpretation about them too. You know, are we going to sources outside of ourselves? Are we going to the Bible? Are we going to our relationship with God? Or are we just kind of locked up in our own little world, our own sphere, this glass sphere that's translucent that really doesn't give you a relationship with things outside of yourself, including God? We know that our relationship with God is obscured. So are you in that translucent sphere? Or the second way of being that Augustine describes is being open to God, okay? Augustine uses two different words here, describes two different types of people. The curious, okay? He says he labels one curious, he labels another studious, okay? Those are his words, you know. He liked those descriptions. The curious are in this first category, shut up in this translucent sphere. They want to own every little bit of knowledge that they have. They want to control it. They want to make their own view of what the world is. And very often, of course, that's it's a sinful view. It's a view that's obstructed to what reality is. So the curious, an obstructed view of reality, an isolated view, a view that's not attached to God, those are the curious. The studious are those that use their knowledge as a way to get to know God, a way to really get to know their world. The studious are better stewards of their knowledge. So what does that mean? We know, we talk about all the time what it means to be a good steward of something. God blesses you with something. You're supposed to be a good steward of that. You're supposed to use it for the glory of God, okay? You're supposed to use it for the service of other people, you know, the widow, the poor. Bible talks about these things all the time. But the studious is a better steward of what he knows. He's not just isolated in this translucent sphere where he doesn't see or relate to anything. The studious person is relating to God and what he knows, and he's relating to the rest of his world. He also, the studious person, according to Augustine, okay, also doesn't want to hold on to what he knows. It's not this closed world that he has. It's not, I've got the knowledge, it's my knowledge, I've got sovereignty over it. Okay, that's what the curious person does. The studious person, again, is outward oriented, oriented toward God, oriented toward other people, oriented to really what is an infinite way of being. When you're oriented toward God, everything is possible, right? When your world, when you think that your world is formed by yourself and controlled by yourself, the knowledge that you have is controlled by yourself, that's a very limited world, isn't it? Very small. So the curious person is kind of locked into that translucent sphere where he doesn't perceive very well. The studious person, okay, is looking outward all the time. He's a better steward of what he knows. So given that little bit of an introduction to what the way Augustine breaks these things down, I wanted to go through the Westminster Larger Catechism again. There's a lot there, as you know, but think about this as we go through, say, question 144, which I have on your handout there. What are the duties required in the Ninth Commandment? The answer, the duties required in the Ninth Commandment, and there are many here, but try to think about them as we go along in general. Okay, the duties, the preserving and promoting of truth between man and man. Okay, already we're looking outward, aren't we? We're looking to other people. We're looking to the relationships with our neighbors, okay? Preserving and promoting of truth between man and man. The preserving and promoting of a good name of our neighbor as well as our own. Again, outward directed. A charitable esteem of our neighbors. Loving, desiring, rejoicing in their good name. Sorrowing for and covering of their infirmities. Freely acknowledging of their gifts and graces. Defending their innocency. A ready receiving of a good report concerning them, unwillingness to admit to of an evil report concerning them, discouraging talebearers, flatterers, slanderers. You see, this is the godly outlook that the Westminster Larger Catechism describes to us. All of these things are outside directed, aren't they? These are not things that we own. We don't own truth. You know, we don't own goodness. Loving, desiring, and rejoicing in their good name, in the good name of our neighbor. Sorrowing for and covering of their infirmities. Freely acknowledging of their gifts and graces. This is somebody who's looking outward to his world, okay? It's a world that he's not just owning himself. We'll see in just a little while, lying is just the opposite, isn't it? If you think about yourself when you lie, we all do it, we all have lots of experience, we're experts, okay, in lying. When you think about that, what are you doing? You're creating something yourself, aren't you? Okay? You're saying, well, I know what that person is really like, but I want everybody else to perceive him in this way. So I'm going to create something different. I'm going to create something that is very restricted, and it does not really describe that person. It's a lie. Okay? So that curious person, that person who's not oriented to God, when we are not oriented to God the way we should, we close our world up and we start to make things up. We start to lie. The opposite is what we're describing here, what the Larger Catechism is describing here. It's describing a worldview that is outward oriented, oriented toward God, open to God and open to our neighbors. So, going on with the Larger Catechism, appearing and standing for the truth. This is one of the things that the Ninth Commandment requires of us, okay? Appearing and standing for the truth, okay? Of course, God is truth. 1 John 5:6, this is he who came by water and blood, Jesus Christ, not by the water only, but by the water and the blood. And the Spirit is the one who testifies, because the Spirit is truth. Okay? Appearing and standing for the truth. Okay? That's what we're supposed to be doing. That's what the Ninth Commandment requires. John 4:24, God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. Again, truth is oriented to God. Okay? It's also oriented to your neighbor. This is that studious category that Augustine gives us. It's outward oriented. It's oriented toward God. It's infinite. Okay, that studious category, goes on forever because it is related to God. It's about God. Westminster Larger Catechism goes on. Requirements of the Ninth Commandment again. From the heart, sincerely, freely, clearly, fully speaking the truth, and only the truth in matters of judgment and justice. Okay? That's easy to understand, isn't it? From the heart, severely, freely, clearly, fully speaking the truth, and only the truth. Okay? This is a person that's oriented toward God. He's outside of his sphere, his restricting sphere. It's an infinite way of looking at things because God is infinite. Going on, from the heart, sincerely, freely, and clearly speaking the truth, and only the truth in all other things whatsoever. You know, the Westminster Larger Catechism really puts us out there, doesn't it? It doesn't restrict it to our own little conception of things, okay? It's about all things. It's about God's creation. It's about God, how God reveals himself in creation. We have the translucent window. Light comes through there. There's light out there. We have hope in the light that we can have in Jesus Christ. God is always there. Untruth is contrary to God's being, contrary to the light that is in creation. Going on with the Westminster Larger Catechism again. Again, this is the requirements of the Ninth Commandment. Love and care of our own good name, defending it when need requireth, keeping of lawful promises, studying and practicing of whatsoever things are true, honest, lovely, and of good report. Boy, if you don't remember anything else from the Westminster Larger Catechism in this question, this is the one to remember, okay? Studying and practicing of whatsoever things are true, honest, and lovely. Keep those three words in your mind. True, honest, and lovely. Okay? This is our orientation toward Jesus Christ, isn't it? This is the way we should be. It's not a closed-in way of looking at the world. It's not a lie that we have created. Truthfulness, honesty, things that are lovely, that's what we should be looking at. Now, we can go a little bit deeper philosophically into this, and we realize that if truth, okay, is from God, of God, you know, Holy Spirit is truth, God is truth, Jesus Christ is truth. If truth is God, then everything that's not truth is what? Is nothing, right? God is the only truth. It's the only existence that's there, okay? If we, you and I, create some story about somebody else, or we lie, we state something that's supposed to be factual and it's not, okay? Basically, we know that what? That doesn't even exist. It's nothing, isn't it? You know, God is truth. When we try to create these things ourselves, these truths ourselves, it's nothing. Some people some of the philosophers use this word, a phantasm. Okay, we can sort of get an idea. It's a fantasy, okay? A fantasy is nothing. It's not true. You might say, well, yes, I read the book. It was a fiction book, and I like fiction books, but it's not true. It's nothing, you know, for eternity. It's nothing. And we have to realize that when we close ourselves up, okay, when we're not dealing with God, when we're not relating to God, we're not relating to our neighbor, okay? What we have is untruth. What we have is a phantasm. What we have is nothing, okay? So the curious person exists in a world which is really nothing. And when we are lying, we're really basing our existence in nothing. It's a phantasm. Now, we're going to go on to the next question of the Larger Catechism. I wanted to just sort of make a relationship here. I don't know if you guys remember from Deuteronomy. I think they have this in your handout. These two questions reminded me of this, the judgment and curses from Deuteronomy 27:11-14. This is just before the Israelites are coming into the promised land. It says, beginning in verse 11, that day Moses charged the people, saying, When you have crossed over the Jordan, these shall stand on Mount Gerizim to bless the people, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Joseph, and Benjamin. And these shall stand on Mount Ebal for the curse. Okay, Reuben, Gad, Asher, Zebulun, Dan, and Naphtali. Kind of a funny thing, isn't it? Two different mountains, okay? One mountain represents blessing, Gerizim. The other, Mount Ebal, represents cursing. And these two questions, you know, we have our first question, 144. It talks about what the ninth commandment requires of us. And all that those things that we just listed are really blessings, aren't they? It's the way we relate to other people. It's the way we relate to God. Where we're going now, question 145, is kind of the cursing part of it, the blessing and the cursing. God tells us the consideration of both of these things is very important. We need to look at them because these things often reflect the way we are and help us in our relationship with God and with our neighbor. So question 45, what are the sins forbidden in the ninth commandment? Okay, the sins forbidden in the ninth commandment. So we're talking about lying and truth here, but we're also talking about sin in general. And we should be able to come to some conclusions regarding the sins. The sins forbidden in the ninth commandment, the larger catechism says, all prejudicing of the truth. Okay? Think about just that phrase. All prejudicing of the truth. Everything that is against the truth, okay, is prohibited, is a sin. Think about what we just said about phantasm. Anything that's against the truth is nothing. You know, we in our society today, you know, people talk about what happens after death, okay? And if you ask a lot of people, both inside and outside the church, but we'll talk about outside the church, what happens after death? Nothing. It's all black. There's no explanation that they have for what happens to themselves after death. It's all black. And we know that this is true. If you're not oriented toward Jesus Christ, then there's nothing. And after death, you have nothing to look forward to. You have nothing but blackness. All prejudicing of the truth. All alteration of the truth. Lying, okay, is a sin forbidden in the ninth commandment. We've said this over and over. But what is it? It's nothingness. It's a big zero. It's darkness. Going on, all prejudicing of the good name of our neighbors. All prejudicing of our own good name. Can you see this thing tightening down? I feel like I'm being restricted here as I read this. This is not the position of the Christian, the studious, as Augustine says, that's open to God and open to other people. This is a very closed-in way of looking at the world. All prejudicing of the truth, it's against God. All prejudicing of the good name of our neighbors, okay? Again, things are closing in. You're ending up in your own little isolated sphere. All prejudicing of our own good name, okay? Why is that part of this closing in? Because we're created, what, in the image of God. Again, if we're not going to represent ourselves truthfully, we're still standing against God, aren't we? We're standing against that image of God that He made us. Okay? We're made in the image of God. So these things of untruth are closing us in. You know, we can live in a world of a complete lie. And a lot of times we do. I worked with a guy a number of years ago who, and you people may remember having an acquaintance like this as well, who started down that path of lying and confabulating, and everything that he talked about, he couldn't help himself but to create some lie out of it, okay? He told us he had associations with the president, the pope. Everything that came up in the news, he associated himself with, okay? He finally got to the point where he didn't know where truth was and where falsehood was. He couldn't tell the difference. And this happens to people. I've known a few people like this. You go down that road, if you want to live in that untruth, you finally lose your connection to anything that is truthful. It's a big blackness, okay? He finally got to the point where he couldn't speak truth about anything, okay? And this was a highly technically involved person. So, prejudicing the truth, the good name of our neighbors, our own good name, okay, is all contrary to God, and it closes us up in this little sphere that we make for ourselves in sin. If we prejudice the good name of somebody else, we're really impugning the whole person, meaning that that person is nothing, okay? If you are going against lying about that person, you're basically saying that to yourself, that person is nothing. But there's light, okay? We've said that even looking at this translucent glass here, there's light that comes through. You and I have the confidence that God is there, that there is light. Look at Psalm 36:9. For with you is the fountain of life. In your light do we see light. Nice way to think about it, isn't it? God, God, in your light do we see light. Again, this is the studious person, oriented toward God, oriented toward his fellow man, toward his neighbor, toward all that God has made in truth. 1 John 1:5, this is the message we have heard from him and proclaimed to you, that God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all. And Revelation 22:5, and night will be no more. They will need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light, and they will reign forever and ever. It's talking about the elect, isn't it? Talking about believers in Jesus Christ. They will need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord will be their light. Their light comes from the external. The Lord will be their light, and they will reign forever and ever. Okay? So when we attempt to control the truth, when we're lying, when we're making things up, we're closing out that light, aren't we? We're really isolating ourselves, we think, from God. Look at, I put a quotation there, I believe, from Augustine again. Your eyes participate in the light, and so you see. Do they close? You have not diminished the light. Do they open? You have not increased the light. Seems simplistic, doesn't it? Okay, we know that. You close your eyes, you don't see the light. Does that mean the light is gone? No. Augustine knows that he has to say these simple things to us because we tend to think in these ways. If I turn away from God, does that mean that God is not there? Does that mean that the light is not there? No, it doesn't. The light is still there. You're just not participating in it, okay? And this idea of participation is a nice way to think about your life. Ask yourself day by day, you get up in the morning, Pastor Ben likes to talk about these things. I think he does it so well. What he said, we all wake up legalists every morning, okay? That's another sinful way of being. But ask yourself, when you wake up that way, I wake up that way a lot, you know, in a grump and legalism, trying to follow all the rules perfectly, so forth and so on. Ask yourself, are you participating, okay? In this case, are you participating in the light? Are you drawing that into yourself? Are you looking at what's out there? Are you participating or not? Your eyes participate in the light, and so you see. Do they close? You have not diminished the light. Do they open? You have not increased the light. God is still there. Do you want to close your eyes and separate yourself from God? We do that, don't we? That's not our way of being. We want to participate in the light. Now, there's a poet, Richard Wilbur, that I like a lot. His view of this is just from one of his poems called The Eye, okay? He says, this poem says, correct my view that the lid's closure frees me, okay? This is sort of a prayer that he is saying to God. Correct my view that the lid's closure, that your eyelid's closure frees me. It doesn't free you to turn away from God, okay? Closing your eyes to God doesn't give you more freedom. God is still sovereign. Okay? God is still there. God is still loving. He is everything that He is. And Wilbur prays in this poem, The Eye, correct my view that the lid's closure frees me. Get that idea out of my mind that when I close my eyes, that I don't need to pay attention to you. When I turn away from you, Lord, that I have more freedom. A lot of times we think this way, don't we? Unbelievers are particularly steeped in that kind of belief. Well, if I don't look at God, if I'm not paying attention to God, if I don't read the Bible, if I don't learn and grow in Him, then I have more freedom, you know. Jesus Christ is too restrictive, okay? God is too restrictive. The Bible is too restrictive. And Wilbur says, correct that view in me. He's praying that that view would be corrected, that the lids, the eyelids closure frees me. It doesn't. When you close your eyes, the light is still there. God is still there in all His glory, okay? But we have trouble seeing it. We turn a blind eye, as we say, okay? We are stuck in our world of sin that obscures to us what God is. God does not change. It does not obscure Him. So light can seem minuscule at times. It can seem little. You know, sometimes we feel like we're in the darkness. We know the light's out there. And sometimes the light seems minimal. But look how the Bible describes the light coming from God as it tries to break in on us. Exodus 19:16, on the morning of the third day, there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast so that all the people in the camp trembled. This is the presence of God on Mount Sinai, okay? When the law was being given, okay? Thunders and lightnings. This is one way we should see the light of God. Job 37:4, after it, His voice roars. He thunders with His majestic voice, and He does not restrain the lightnings when His voice is heard. God imposes His light on us. That light is still there. Closing our eyes does not do away with God. Psalm 97:4, His lightnings light up the world. The earth sees and trembles. Matthew 24:27, for as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Interesting vision there, isn't it? You know how it is with lightning. You're in a dark storm. My son lives in St. Louis. They have all kinds of storms down there, you know, lots of lightning and thunder. Well, when you're in those clouds and those horrible storms down there, lightning comes, and what does it do? Lights up the whole business, doesn't it? Okay? Not only shows you the power of God, but the light suffuses everything. Okay? Lightning is so bright and moves out so quickly and powerfully, you can't even hardly look at it because it's so bright. Okay? Lightning suffuses everything. It's like God, He's still there. Revelation 4:5, from the throne came flashes of lightning and rumblings and peals of thunder, and before the throne were burning seven torches of fire, which are the seven spirits of God. The seven perfect spirits of God. The number seven shows perfection. Flashes of lightning, rumblings, and peals of thunder before the throne. This is God. All right?
Yep. Ah.
Good. So, talking about flashes of light, thanks for telling me that. I only listen to myself. I don't know what everybody else is doing, but at any rate. So, but flashes of lightning and rumblings and peals of thunder, the light of God imposes itself on his creation. Another quotation from Richard Wilbur here. It's an interesting one for us to think about. You guys know your Bibles. You know the Holy of Holies, okay? You know the mercy seat in the Holy of Holies. And Wilbur describes this, just a line from his poem, Icarium Mari. It's a beautiful poem if you guys get a chance to read it sometime. This one line or two lines, where else do lifting wings proclaim the advent of the fire-gapped thunderhead? Okay, look at that. It's a little tricky to think about, but where else do lifting wings proclaim? You remember Holy of Holies, the mercy seat? The cherubim on either side, their wings pointing toward each other, okay? Lifting wings of the cherubim. Where else, he asks, do lifting wings proclaim the advent of the fire-gapped thunderhead? Those lifting wings of the cherubim on either side of the mercy seat are proclaiming what? They're proclaiming God, who Wilbur describes here as the fire-gapped thunderhead, that bright light, that noise, okay, that sovereignty, that power of God, those two cherubim with their raised wings on either side of the mercy seat proclaim the advent, the presence of the fire-gapped thunderhead, okay? Hard to get an impression of that. How does that work? We know lightning, we know thunder. I can kind of give you an example. When I was in high school and college, I worked in a movie theater, and I showed the movies. I ran the projector. And in that time, we didn't have xenon light bulbs. Xenon light bulbs had just been invented at that time. We didn't have those. What we had was a carbon arc, okay? You had two carbon rods, okay? One positive charge, one negative charge. And what we did to light them up, we had little knobs that brought them together. And with that positive and negative, Roger knows all about this, this electronics business, you know. These two very powerful positive negative charges come together, okay, you get a really bright light all of a sudden. So we had to bring them together, make a gap, and then there was a motor that kept them in that gap exactly right for that whole time that those carbon rods were burning. And that had enough light that it threw from way back in the upper part of the theater all the way down to the screen so you could watch a movie. That was really bright light. And we were really close to it, so we really had an impression of what this fire-gapped thunderhead is all about. Okay? Carbon arc, the light of God, thunders, lightning. You know, this is God's light suffusing the universe. So despite our sin of lying, okay, our attempts to enclose ourselves and to close our eyes against God, to turn away from God, okay, his light still suffuses. As Augustine tells us, we close our eyes, the light is still there. Westminster Larger Catechism, as we go on with that, especially we're supposed to be truthful in public judicature, it says. That means in the courts, okay, when you're testifying. We know that in our courts, as we read about these things in the newspaper, that a lot of the things that go on in the courts are trying to obscure the truth, right? It's really not trying to bring the truth out. People are trying to bring about what they want to happen. So there's a lot of obscuration of the truth in the courts. Well, Larger Catechism says, you know, that's one of the sins that we perpetrate, and it's admonishing us that especially in the courts, in public, okay, especially in public where we're supposed to be representing Jesus Christ, we shouldn't be obscuring all of these things. I put in Romans 13, 1 through 7 in your handout there just to show that these public places, okay, are part of the authority of God. For there is no authority except from God. We're supposed to respect these things. We're supposed to represent Jesus Christ in those settings, okay? We're supposed to be a reflection of the light of God there. We're supposed to demonstrate our faithfulness, okay? We're supposed to glorify God in those settings. So especially in those very public settings, you know, we need to be truthful. So the other sins associated with bearing false witness, calling evil good and good evil, that's a common topic in our society today because we want to mix those things around. Calling good evil and evil good and good evil, that's part of our isolation from God, isn't it? It's part of our turning around. It's part of you bringing in this sphere that's so tight and tries to isolate itself from God. Larger catechism goes on, rewarding the wicked according to the work of the righteous and the righteous according to the work of the wicked. Forgery, concealing the truth, undue silence in a just cause. Okay? Can silence be lying? You guys know it can be. You're in a setting, you're supposed to say something, you're supposed to bring some truth out that you know, and you decide, nope, not going to do that. Not going to say anything. I might ruffle some feathers. I might bring about something that I don't want to bring about. So undue silence in a just cause. We're supposed to speak out. We're supposed to represent God's truth. Speaking the truth unseasonably, okay, well, saying the truth, but for a wrong motive, okay? We're trying to accomplish something else. It's a little more complex, but we do that. We've seen it done as well. Speaking truth maliciously to a wrong end, perverting truth to a wrong meaning, in doubtful or equivocal expressions to the prejudice or the truth or justice. We know that we can twist truth so that it looks like it means something else. That's what it's talking about. And then a long list of these other things that are prohibited. Speaking untruth, lying, slandering, backbiting, detracting, talebearing, whispering, scoffing, reviling, rash, harsh, and partial censuring, okay? Misconstructing intentions, words, and actions. Flattering, vainglorious, boasting. Boasting about ourselves. Even though it may be true, okay? If I boast about myself, which I'm prone to do, you guys know that. If I boast about myself, I'm really not representing a truth, am I? I'm not representing the fact that I'm a fallen person under God, okay? So vainglorious boasting is prohibited by this working toward truth. Romans 3, 9 through 11, no one is righteous. What then? Are we Jews any better off? No, not at all, for we have already charged that all, both Jews and Greeks, are under sin. As it is written, none is righteous, no, not one. No one understands, no one seeks for God. Okay? That's why vainglorious boasting is wrong. Let's keep running through this list here from the Catechism. These things that are prohibited, thinking or speaking too highly or too meanly of ourselves or others, too highly or too meanly, okay? If you speak too highly of yourself, what, you're representing yourself as a person who has no sin. If you speak too meanly, if you degrade yourself too much, you're degrading the image of God, right? Denying the gifts and graces of God, aggravating smaller faults, hiding, excusing, or extenuating of sins when called to a free confession, unnecessary discovering of infirmities, okay, going to look for what's wrong with everybody else, okay, raising false rumors, receiving and countenancing evil reports, okay. We like to listen to all this stuff in the paper, don't we, okay. We read the paper, there's all this stuff going on, we receive it, it's oppressive to us, but then we talk about it to everybody else. So receiving and countenancing evil reports is contrary to the Ninth Commandment as well. Stopping our ears against just defense, evil suspicion, envying or grieving at the deserved credit of any, envying or grieving at the deserved credit. You know, we become envious of everybody else's successes, don't we? That's part of bearing false witness. Endeavoring or desiring to impair, okay, and rejoicing in their disgrace and infamy. Scornful contempt, fond admiration, breach of lawful promises, neglecting such things as are of good report, practicing or not avoiding ourselves, or not hindering what we can in others, such things as procure an ill name. So that means we're supposed to try to influence everybody else in the right direction. The reason I read through this great big list is because, you know, a lot of times, especially with things like the Ninth Commandment, thou shalt not bear false witness against your neighbor, right? We fall right into legalism, like Pastor Ben told us. We all wake up legalists every day, okay? And when we look at this long list that the larger catechism gives us, it's telling us what? It's telling us this is not about following rules or particular ways of being, particular rules that you follow in your life. This is about your lifestyle. This is about your orientation. This is about how you are before God and how you're loving God and loving your neighbor. If you read through this list in the larger catechism, you know, these catechisms get pretty big and wordy. But as you read through them, if you consider them individually, carefully, you'll find out this is not about a bunch of little rules. This is about what our orientation is. Are we oriented toward the light? Are we trying to get rid of that translucency? Are we trying to relate to God and to all those others around us? Or are we trying to close in? Or are we trying to be open to God and to our neighbor? So, I don't know if that's convicting for you or not. I think it is a description of how we are. Okay. We return to Augustine now. If this is sinful speech that we've been talking about, okay, both in a positive and in a negative way, Ninth Commandment requires these things and prohibits these other things, but it's all about a way of being, then do you feel kind of trapped? How should I be? You know, telling the truth all the time while I'm sinful, I don't sometimes. Should I feel trapped? What is proper speech? How should we be speaking? We talked about participating in the light, okay? Are we aware of God all the time in what we're doing? Not only in speech, but in our actions, in our orientation, okay? What is non-sinful speech then? Well, Augustine tells us that non-sinful speech is confession. He puts all non-sinful speech in the category of confession. Well, what does that mean? You know, most of you are aware, you know, Augustine's most famous book is called Confessions, okay? Well, if you've read that book, it's not an easy book to read, but it's recommended for everybody. You read Confessions, it's not just him confessing 1,000 or 1,000,000 sins that he's committed in his life. A lot of confessions is simply a statement of the truth about God, okay? It's a statement of the truth about God. Augustine's confessions are stating the truth about God. He confesses his own sins in there as well, but mainly, okay, it's the truth about God. The other thing, if you read Confessions, and this is what, again, Augustine points out to us, there's a couple things that you do when you go before God in confession. We all have this experience if we'll simply notice it. Go to God in prayer. What do you notice about your prayers? About halfway through, I'm sure you guys do the same as I do. I mean, you go, this is really insufficient. I'm talking to God here, okay? I'm telling him about things that are important in my life. I'm trying to get God to do certain things, right? I'm giving him an order sheet here, do this, 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 and this, right? But about halfway through, you say, well, I'm a man. I'm not stating these things very well. Am I asking for godly things? Am I praising the Lord? Okay. Am I confessing? What's going on here? Well, one thing that confession does, and you should be in the mode of confession, is that you're acknowledging your own insufficiency. Okay. When I get up here and talk to you guys, for the whole week beforehand, I'm thinking about my own insufficiency, okay? I'm thinking about, am I going to be able to get this across? I think I have something important to say. Am I going to be able to get this across? Same thing happens when you talk to God. We are really insufficient, okay, in our speech, okay? In fact, some people would say that everything you say is insufficient. Because, and you, I think you might admit this for yourself as well. You have something in your mind that you want to describe, you want to get across, okay? Do you ever get it across? I don't ever feel like I get it across the way I want to, okay? My family and my friends will tell you, he's always repeating, okay? Why does he do that? And the reason I do that is I think I never get my point across. And I think you all understand that experience. We're insufficient in our conversation, even if it's a silent conversation, okay? Remember Hannah and her silent prayers, okay? Even there, she, I'm sure, didn't feel like she was getting across. Wonderful prayer, but not getting across what she wanted to. So we have to go before God in insufficiency, okay? Confession is an acknowledgement of your insufficiency. If you read Augustine's Confessions, he acknowledges that over and over and over again. So it's an acknowledgement of our insufficiency and of God's all-sufficiency. He's sufficient in all things. If you start there in your conversation with God, if you start there as your idea of confession before God, your own insufficiency and God's all-sufficiency, that's very reformed, isn't it? Okay? We're insufficient, okay? He is all-sufficient. That's what confessing is all about. So Augustine says, the only good speech that we have is confessive speech, is when we go and we speak in our own insufficiency and acknowledging God's all-sufficiency. Doesn't make any difference where you are. You're in the boardroom, you're in the shop, wherever you are, okay? You go to somebody else and you try to get something accomplished. You go there saying, boy, am I going to be able to get this across, you know? Maybe not completely, but that humility that you go, knowing your own insufficiency, okay, helps that process. In a similar way, you go before the board, you go before people at work, wherever, okay, and you're going with the idea of the all-sufficiency of God, that His light suffuses all things, okay? You go in confession, your own insufficiency, God's all-sufficiency, and that's where you get to a good interaction with your neighbor and with God, of course, okay? You go in confession, your own insufficiency and God's all-sufficiency, okay? So run that around in your mind. Isaiah 8:20, to the law and to the testimony, if they speak not according to this word, the written word, it is because there is no light in them. Okay? If you acknowledge your own insufficiency, you realize you need to be in the Word of God constantly, okay, then you might be able to accomplish something. But if you don't, if the Bible, if your relationship with God is not the thing that drives your conversation, there's no light in you. There's no light there. We have to live in God. We have to live as the studious. Again, studious, oriented toward God, okay, and oriented towards your neighbor, okay, oriented toward truth. It's not this closed-in thing. It's the thing that the larger catechism describes, this great complete look at what our lives are like, what our individual orientation toward things is. It's an open way of being. It's not a closed way of being. The studious, okay, going to others in confession. I wanted to end today with this thing from Johannes Kepler, okay? You guys know Johannes Kepler. He was a great astronomer, physicist, okay? He was also a very religious man, okay? And a quote from him, you guys have probably heard this before. You may not have known where it comes from because I've heard it attributed to a lot of different people. So Kepler says, I was merely thinking God's thoughts after him. He's talking about his scientific work, okay? I was merely thinking God's thoughts after him. He's acknowledging his own insufficiency, isn't he? Okay? No, I didn't. One of the things that Kepler did is he was able to show the rotation of the planets. I mean, how would you like to try to figure that out? You know, all the mathematics and the observations that go with it. And here this great scientist says that he, his own work, his efforts were really insufficient. He was actually just observing what God put out there, okay? I was merely thinking God's thoughts after him. You go to God in confession, and no matter what you do, here's Kepler, scientist, very astute scientist. I was merely thinking God's thoughts after him. He goes in confession, realizing his own insufficiency and realizing the all-sufficiency of God. Kepler, he used religious arguments and reasoning to do his work. He was motivated by religious conviction and the belief that God had created the world according to an intelligible plan. We've heard all those kinds of phrases before. But here's a guy, you would think he's in his observatory by himself, his own little sphere, right? We've talked about this sphere where we close ourselves in. Especially as scientists, we try to do that. We close ourselves in. And yet, Kepler is not the curious person who makes a few observations and owns them for himself and says, this is the world that I have created. Kepler says, he makes the studious argument. He makes himself studious, okay? Remember, studious, oriented toward God, okay? Oriented toward truth, that infinity of truth that's out there. I was merely thinking God's thoughts after him. So Kepler's a good example of the studious person, the Christian person, the godly person, who is confessing, okay, his own insufficiency and the all-sufficiency of God. And that's what he was observing in the universe. So, well, time to be finished, I think. They probably already cut us off the air. You know, like, what about this back there? So next week, I believe we're going to start a new topic. We'll see what happens between now and then. And why don't we close in prayer?